From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about who is funding the candidates in the state Supreme Court race, which has again broken spending records. Then in this month's group chat, we'll hear a conversation between two abortion providers in Wisconsin.
The biggest thing that I really think about is just that, like, in no other procedure is it this heavily regulated. The government is not highly involved except for in abortion care.
Plus, we'll tell you about the recent Black Feminist Symposium event at UWM.
Black feminist thinkers, activists, and scholars have long contributed to both academic and social movements. And this symposium allows for the celebration of that legacy, and it amplifies the voices that have been historically marginalized.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Season 2 of WUWM's podcast, Swing State of the Union, explores the Wisconsin Supreme Court, how court races have changed over the past 30 years, and why this supposedly nonpartisan election feels so partisan. The fifth and final episode, Crawford versus Schimmel, is out now. The episode explores the stated positions of each candidate, what is resonating with voters, and what's at stake this election. The race has already shattered the spending record for a state court campaign, with donations topping $76 million before early voting began. Producers and co-hosts Joy Powers and Sam Woods spoke with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel watchdog columnist Dan Bice about who was funding each campaign.
Who are some of the big money donors who are a part of this campaign right now? Let's start with specifically Schimmel's campaign.
Most of the money on Schimmel's side is being spent by outside actors, and Elon Musk is far and away the biggest, spending more money than anybody else. He's paying for people to go door to door. He's paying for digital ads. He's paying for TV ads. He's paying for mailers, and they're putting things on people's doors. He's got three groups that are operating. One called America PAC. America PAC is the super PAC that he created, and he mostly funds. There are a couple other people who put money into it, but it's mainly his. And he put about $250 million into that and helped Trump win the election with that. And they were very big and active in Wisconsin. They were very active in getting what's called low propensity voters to come out and vote for Trump in Wisconsin, mainly men, young men who didn't vote often. They got out around the state and got those individuals to come and vote. Now, very important in the race. There's another group called Building America's Future. Building America's Future is a nonprofit, and there are certain nonprofits that spend money. And when I write about them, I call them a dark money group because the group never has to disclose who is putting money in there. But the Wall Street Journal wrote that starting in 2022, Elon Musk became the major funder of the organization. And so it's paying for TV ads in all five markets around Wisconsin. So you're not going to escape the TV ad for that group. And then thirdly, and probably most interesting, but the smallest of them, is a group called Progress 2028. Progress 2028 is not registered anywhere. It's not disclosing anything. It's a fake group that puts out ads acting like it's supporting Susan Crawford, but it's not really. It's saying, you know, send a note to Susan Crawford thanking her for the fact that she prefers to let prisoners go rather than locking them up. Well, that's not her position, but they're trying to associate her with unpopular views. And this same group was active in Pennsylvania. It was active in Michigan and a couple other places doing similar fake ads for Kamala Harris, tying her to gun buyback programs and other things like that. And they're trying to say, we're a liberal group. And they even describe themselves as a liberal group in their ads that you see. But those are the Elon Musk groups. And then there's the other major group is called Fair Courts America. And that's Richard Eline, one of the co-owners of Uline Packaging. I think last year he and his wife were the second biggest spenders in the election overall, spent more than $140 million on elections around the country in 2024. The difference is he tends to spend money on groups that he controls. She likes to give money to parties. And in this instance, she has. She's given almost $1 million to the Republican Party, and then that money was transferred to Schimmel. So Schimmel's raising money on his own, too. He got in a race way earlier than Susan Crawford did. And so he's been raising money since December of 2023.
And then same question, but for Crawford, who are her big money donors?
On her side, most of the money, it appears, is going through her campaign. People are giving money to her or to Democratic Party. And there's a strategic reason for doing that, and that is that campaigns and candidates, the ad rate for them is much lower than it is if you're any outside group. So right now, Republicans and the conservatives have spent more, but they both have gotten the same amount of time on TV. And so we don't know all the groups that have given money to her. We do know there are several people that the other side is like to highlight. George Soros, the billionaire Democratic mega donor, he's given $1 million at least to her campaign. The governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, has given $500,000. The co-founder of LinkedIn has given another $500,000. So that's what's going to happen, is the money is going through her campaign on one side, and on the other, it's outside groups.
Would you say there's a difference in the content or tone between ads that have been paid for by the candidate and those that are paid for by groups that are supporting these candidates?
The one difference is the outside groups are not trying to do biographical ads, as they're called. Usually in an election, when you're running in the race, and the Marquette poll showed recently that a majority of people, three-fifths of people in Wisconsin, didn't know who Susan Crawford was, despite these tens of millions of dollars that's been spent, and two-fifths of people hadn't heard of Brad Schimmel, even though he was a statewide elected official. And so you usually start off your race by telling people who you are. And Schimmel has decided to bring his family into the discussion about abortion because he's adopted two children and has said that he's fully supportive of adoption, and that's consistent with his views on abortion, that that you should focus on adopting children instead of getting abortions and so forth. But both of them have brought up their backgrounds and that sort of stuff. But then starting in mid to late February, her campaign ad started attacking him in a pretty strong way. And she had more money than he did. And so he did this interesting thing where he started calling on the outside groups. In particular, he started calling on the Wisconsin Manufacturers Commerce, the state's business lobby, Fair Courts America, and other groups to get involved in the race because he knew they had more money than he did. And days later, they jumped in and started attacking her in a big way.
You talked a bit about why Elon Musk would be interested in this race. We are seeing a lot of national interest just in general. In your view, is this largely ideological? Are these two sides really viewing this as a partisan race? Why is there so much national interest?
The interest is because, as we know, for president, our elections of 50 states, they're elections that focus on 5, 6, 7 swing states, and Wisconsin's one of the swing states. You know, the last election was the closest election in the country was in Wisconsin in 2020. There were 4 lawsuits asking the Supreme Court to throw out the results of the election and to take the election away from Biden and give it to Trump. And the 7 members of the Supreme Court were the ones to decide that. And in each case, the court at that time was controlled by the conservatives, a 4-3 majority. And in each case, the 3 liberals and 1 conservative, Brian Hagedorn, voted to reject those lawsuits. There were also lawsuits before the election occurred. There was one, the Green Party wanted to be on the ballot. They had a candidate who wanted to run for president, and there were problems with their paperwork. And so the election commission said, you can't get on the ballot. And the idea was that they would siphon votes away from Biden if they were on the ballot. And again, by a 4-3 vote, the Supreme Court made the decision not to let them on the ballot. And in the end, Biden won by a very small percentage, by 20,000 votes or so. And so the election in Wisconsin's important, but the election could come down to a decision by the state Supreme Court as to what happens with the results and the framework of who gets on the ballot, whether we have election boxes, any number of other things. And then after the election, whether it was handled properly and whether they should have recounts, all sorts of things like that are going to be decided by the Supreme Court. There's also this concern that voter ID is going to come up and that if Crawford wins, that she and the liberals will get rid of voter ID and that will that will have an impact on the election. So there are issues that are of concern primarily and exclusively to people in Wisconsin, but the consequences of this race could be felt nationwide, and that people who are interested in the 2028 presidential race are very much concerned and interested in what's going on here. And so, you know, the head of the National Republican, the Republican National Committee said this is the most important race in the country. Trump's people have said this is the most important race in the country this year. People on the left have said this is the most important race in the country. And so I've started to think maybe this is the most important race in the country.
Dan Bice is a watchdog columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spoke with Joy Powers and Sam Woods for WUWM's podcast, Swing State of the Union. All episodes of Season 2 are available now. You can find it at WUWM.com and wherever you get your podcasts. You can also hear it tomorrow at noon right here on WUWM. There are few words that polarize people as much as abortion. But how do the people who provide that care feel? For this month's group chat, we hear a conversation between two care providers. We're using only their first initials to protect them from facing any kind of repercussions or harm. Here's a conversation between L, an abortion-providing doctor, and K, a high-risk outreach worker.
I'm Elle. I am an abortion provider in the state of Wisconsin, and I'm here to talk about my experiences as someone who provides abortion care.
I'm Kay. I'm a harm reductionist, high-risk outreach worker, and board member for an abortion clinic.
So tell me about your family.
My family has always been led by very strong agency. I was taught at a very young age by my family how important agency is. My mom was a teen mom, so she got pregnant at 16. When she got pregnant, or I should say when the school found out she got pregnant, she was actually kicked out of high school and was forced to go to a night school just for pregnant people. That story was always part of her identity, low-key kind of part of my sister's identity and our birth stories. I was a home birth, my sister was a home birth, and the room was literally crowded with all of our family members. Our birth stories have always just been super important. And I think it had a lot to do with because my mom recognized when identity is taken from you, what that leads to.
How do you feel they impacted the work that you do?
Informs the work I do every day because I want people to be able to live the life that they feel like they deserve to live. And they deserve their agency respected. People deserve to have their autonomy respected. People deserve to be able to decide for themselves what is best for them and what they want for themselves.
Yeah, I totally hear that.
Yeah. I bet you see that as well, being a doctor.
You know, The biggest thing that I really think about is just that, in no other procedure is it this heavily regulated. As a physician, you can kind of just, you can do whatever you want most of the time. The government is not highly involved except for in abortion care. There are many other probably higher risk procedures that are done with less supervision by the government that I feel don't get the attention that they need. And there are probably people who do get hurt. And I think it's important to just talk about that, to talk about how it doesn't really make that much sense that this is so heavily regulated, even though it is more dangerous to remain pregnant than it is to have a termination.
I say that all the time, that reproductive healthcare is just healthcare.
It's just healthcare.
It's just healthcare. what's something that people don't know about abortion, abortion care, or access to abortion that may surprise them?
I think the biggest thing that surprises people is that we're actually really nice to them. I think they think that we're like really mean and that we're really bad doctors and that we do this because we can't do anything else, but that's not the case. The thing that surprises most people that I hear the most frequently is they're like, you guys are so nice. And sometimes I ask people, like, what did you expect to happen when you came in here? And they just expected a lot of people to be really cold, or they expected to be judged for their decision. But I don't ask people what their decisions are. It doesn't matter as long as no one's making them do this and they feel good about the decision that they're making, or they feel like it's something that they're okay with moving forward doing. It doesn't matter their decision. So I just don't ask. It's not my business. You know, it's very easy for a wanted pregnancy to turn into a termination when people don't have resources that they need. And that's the thing that I think is lost on a lot of people, that we're doing this work because we think that people deserve to have access, but it's not in isolation that people want to have terminations. I think that many people want to grow their families and many people want to do that, and they are just in a set of circumstances a lot of the time that isn't conducive to that, and that we're a Band-Aid on a larger problem that they are experiencing.
I resonate with that completely. It's all encapsulating. It's our entire life that we're talking about here. We're not just talking about singular, siloed decisions. We're talking about the outcomes of our entire lives. Mm-hmm. And working with people who are experiencing ongoing regular barriers to basic need resources, or even just like above basic needs, because like people deserve to live quality lives. Mm-hmm. And so if it comes down to having to jeopardize quality of life over what people perceive to be like morally wrong, like I think that is something that we need to unpack and like deconstruct as a society, because why are we okay with a low quality of life in our community? Like, yeah. Why are we okay seeing people not have their housing needs met, not having their food met? Why are we okay with the kids in our community having lead poisoning? Like, why are we okay with pharmacies closing? Why are we okay with the labor and delivery units closing, the cath labs closing? Like, if we say we really care about life, why don't we care about the quality of life?
Yeah. And like basic access to things that people really need. And I think, I don't know, I'm somebody who, I don't know that I've ever had a lot of feelings about abortion. I don't know. I don't know that I understand a lot of the emotion behind it, because even before I started providing this care, it was just another thing. Like, it's just another medical procedure, like watching people do it. There's all kinds of reasons why you empty somebody's uterus. It can be because they were pregnant and they've had a demise. It can be because they're heavily bleeding after a demise. It can be because they have extra parts of their uterus in there and like you need to change the shape of their uterus to help them get pregnant. Like, there's all kinds of reasons why we do this, and that it just is so similar to every other thing that we do that it just kind of feels like another thing I'm doing that day, another way to help people.
I love seeing that, like, that your end of it, though, because as someone who works with people in the community, meeting them like where they're at, for some people really isn't like a big deal. But even when it's not a big deal, that ability to get your needs met is a big deal, because it's the difference between, okay, now I get to go just keep my job and keep my one bedroom rent, and like I get to continue on with my life as it is, versus, oh my gosh, now I have to absolutely prepare for all of this change. And if they're not someone who has, which often in my case, I'm working with people who have severe persistent mental illness, who are living unhoused, who are survivors of sex trafficking. Like, I'm working with some really high risk people in the sense that they are chronically unable to access their needs. That's what leads these people to be high risk. It's really nothing about who they are. It's the fact that we cannot provide for everyone in our community that leaves people in high risk situations. Seeing that, like, the same decision from like both ends of the spectrum is so fascinating for me, because like, you're so right that it is absolutely just another medical procedure. And for like me on my end, it is just another life decision. But that ability to make a decision in your life totally changes the outcome of your life.
And I think a lot about, like, you know, people think about like, well, your choice was to or not get on birth control. And like, a single visit to have an abortion costs less than getting an IUD placed twice if you didn't have any insurance. if you can't get on Medicaid because you make too much money, quote unquote, which is really not very much at all, and you can't afford insurance and you're just like a person who's kind of in the middle, which is a lot of people in this country, I more think it's people's views on abortion are more reflective of how we think about other people and how we think of how we are in connection with other people. I think it can be really easy to think that your situation applies to every other person, which it just doesn't. None of our situations apply to every other person. Every single person deserves to be able to make a decision for themselves about how they are going to conduct their life, including whether or not they are going to have a pregnancy that continues.
Even speaking to this, though, I want to flush out the idea of choice, because like, while it's true, yes, like people deserve to make choice and like have their choices be honored, we also have to very much recognize in the state of our conditions, our current conditions, choice is a very complicated thing.
Yeah.
It's so muddy. People don't really just get to choose, you know, whether that's choosing your access to birth control, right? Mm-hmm. Like, as you're saying, like insurance, so huge. If you're uninsured, paying for an IUD is like $1,200 out of pocket.
It's like, it's some ridiculous amount of money.
It's so expensive.
And you can still get pregnant if you are on birth control. Like, there are still people who can access contraception who end up pregnant.
And that's just talking about, like, how finances muddle this all. Like, there are so many ways where people want to be able to choose to have a child or to not have a child under circumstances that are not current. Like, I do love the energy around like vasectomies lately. Like, I love that like they're getting attention and like validity. Like, yes, vasectomies, we love them. But also recognizing how that is in part, we're making a choice out of conditions. And people are having to do that every day. And while that's kind of like a newer hype for vasectomies, it's not a newer hype for abortion care. People are having to make choices out of conditions. And that's not a true choice. Because if you don't get to choose your housing, if you don't get to choose your employment or your career path, if you don't get to choose your education, if you don't get to choose your transportation, if you don't get to choose your healthcare, if you don't get any of these choices, then like when you are made to make a decision, is it truly a choice? And so that's where like, we have to really lean in and accept that life is complicated. People's lives do not reflect our life. And we have to accept the fact that people are different from us and need different things.
Absolutely.
Because I think it also requires us to adapt a perspective of community care. Like, we have to actually care about other people. And I think that's something that's a very challenging idea in a very individualistic society.
Yeah.
In a very, like how you're pointing out, a very classist society where status and control have so much power and can yield such powerful outcomes. It's necessary that we turn inward and we look to how we can provide care for each other.
Yeah. And how can we look at ourselves and wonder why we don't? It's strange. We have a word for people who can't look at other people and empathize with them. That is how abnormal that is. And so, like, the fact that socially as a whole we're not doing it is really scary, actually. That, like, there is this perception that, like, oh, it would be really weird if I can't empathize with the person sitting next to me. That's really not an appropriate thing. But it's okay that I can't empathize with another choice that someone's making or a decision that someone's making. And so I kind of view that along the same spectrum. Like, this person is part of my community because we're all human beings living on the, like, on the planet together. Mm-hmm. We all have something to offer. We all have something that without each other, we can't get this done. And we have to be able to think about the importance of everyone's contribution and that people are not expendable.
Community is not a commodity.
What brings you joy?
I find truly so much joy being in community. I need to be able to find and create joyful moments being in my community.
Yeah.
How am I creating conversation with the barista when I get to my coffee in the morning? How am I saying hello, you know, to the person who's standing across from me at the gas station as we're pumping gas into our cars? Or like, how am I creating opportunities to truly be present, to build connection, and to ultimately build memories in my community? Like, that brings me so much joy. Like, the talking to my barista thing is like actually so real. I only know my local barista in the context of they make my coffee every day, but they're also on my close friends list on Instagram now.
Oh, that's so nice.
And we never talk to each other, never see them in any other context, but mm-hmm. that 5-minute engagement almost on a daily basis really brings me so much joy. And I see that replicated in any interaction I can have with other community members in that way.
Yeah.
What about you?
That's amazing. I think knowing that all the work I do is inherently resistance. Whatever choice I make that day, I am part of the solution. And that it doesn't have to be anything huge. I don't need to tear it all down today. But every interaction matters. Every choice I make matters. The small things matter, and that the small work matters, and that the time I spend with patients matters, the time that I spend making extra phone calls, the time I spend getting somebody on the phone with a clinic to get them access, or the time I spend making sure that they have access to childcare or paying for this abortion, that matters. And that doesn't go unnoticed. Really brings me joy to know that the small things matters, the choices matter, the intent matters. And that it's really easy to get bogged down with all these different things that I have responsibilities for, all these different things that are hard about my job, but it matters. And even when it feels like it doesn't, people remember, and they remember the effort that you put in. And that makes me know that I am doing something good that day.
That was Elle, a Wisconsin doctor who provides abortions, and Kay, a harm reductionist and outreach worker who serves high-risk populations. This group chat was produced by WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. In about 15 minutes, we'll bring you our latest bubbler talk that explores Lake Michigan's shipwrecks. But first, we'll learn about UWM's Women's Resource Center and a recent event it hosted uplifting Black feminism. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Women's Resource Center at UW-Milwaukee recently hosted its 5th annual Black Feminist Symposium. It's a space that welcomes the community for engaging discussions on the theory and practice of Black feminism. The conference-style event is designed to celebrate, explore, and elevate the voices and experiences of Black women. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, is joined by one of the symposium's organizers, Mia Valenzuela, to learn about the event. Valenzuela starts the conversation explaining how the symposium came to be.
For over 10 years now, the Women's Resource Center has been led or co-led by women of color, predominantly Black women. Our leadership has changed the trajectory of the Women's Resource Center. I mean, we have continuously pushed for more intersectionality, more social justice, and more discussions beyond white feminism. In 2018, our professional staff, a team of 2 Black women, Marvette Lacey and Natasha Lee, began planning a gathering dedicated to, 1, increasing the learning and practice of Black feminism on UWM's campus, 2, providing a supportive and intellectually stimulating environment where students, faculty, and staff and community members can collaborate and share ideas centered on Black feminism, and 3, to foster a learning community of Black feminist thought and scholars in the greater Milwaukee community. So the first Black Feminist Symposium, How We Get Free, was started in February of 2019 during Black History Month. And since then, the event has continued to be uplifted by professional staff like Melissa Monnier, Justice Johnson, Monique Alcantar, the late Victoria Pryor, Ayanna Bose Greer, Casey Otto, and myself.
Can you define Black feminism for people who may have never heard that terminology?
Black feminism, I just want to start by saying it's different than the mainstream feminism that we see, or we see a lot of white feminism in our day-to-day efforts. But Black feminism really focuses on the intersection between being a woman and being Black in the world. And it really uses that intersectionality to propel different thoughts based off of sexism, discrimination, institutional racism, to really empower Black women.
Tell me more about what goes into planning the symposium. What does the final product look like, and what can people expect if they go?
The Black Feminist Symposium has welcomed students, faculty, staff, and community members every year since 2019. Well, except for 2021 during the pandemic. The very first Black Feminist Symposium was actually held in UWM libraries, and the rest have been in the Lubar Entrepreneurship Center, which is a newer space on campus dedicated to supporting innovators, bringing their ideas to life. But each year we have spent a lot of time with the planning committee to select a theme relevant to Black women. This year we considered the idea of Black excellence and how we might empower Black women while also holding space for the pressures of excellence, right? We also considered Black feminist scholar Bell Hooks and her legacy. So we decided on the theme, Ain't I a Woman, Reclaiming Self-Worth and Excellence. So we selected our theme. We chose a keynote speaker. This year, we chose the wonderful Dr. Monique Liston from Ubuntu Research and Evaluation. She is such a force. This was actually the third time we chose her to lead the symposium. So when we have our theme and our keynote speaker have been selected, we actually open submissions to present research to the UWM and greater Milwaukee community. So those submissions are opened about 4 months before the symposium actually starts. And we get a pretty even split between UWM students and faculty and the greater Milwaukee community members that want to present. This year, we selected around 15 submissions to present their work, be it poetry, academic, or lyrical. The space offers a keynote session and then concurrent breakout sessions to attendees. So it's more of like a choose your own adventure in Black feminist thought. Our space also offers a movement session. So during select years, this year included, we had yoga sessions. In other years, we've had dance sessions from Black dance instructors in the cities as well. And then we also host a creators market. So this market serves for local Black women-owned business owners to come and vend their goods, but to also be a part of a panel where folks can learn the ins and outs of having a business today.
So this event has been going on for 5 years at this point. What are some of the things you or the planning team have learned along the way?
Yeah, I think so. When I think about the past 5 years, you know, we've learned a lot. We've walked away with a lot of valuable insights from the Black Feminist Symposium. And we've understood more clearly that there is a large importance not only on intersectional dialogue, but also intergenerational dialogue. The symposium has highlighted the complexities of Black women's experiences, emphasizing issues of race, gender, class, sexuality, disability, and other factors that cannot be separated when discussing justice, right? And a powerful realization that we've had is the importance of fostering conversations between the older and younger generations of Black feminists. Younger attendees may have been able to learn directly from longtime activists, scholars, and leaders, while older generations may have gained new insights from the fresh perspectives of younger participants. You know, this is one of the reasons why we open the symposium up to the public, why the submissions are open to the public, and to be an attendee is open to the public. We've really seen the benefit of having, you know, our younger students interact with community members and then vice versa. That intergenerational exchange just fosters such a sense of continuity and solidarity within the movement. And I think this event too, you know, we've taken notice of an increased focus on mental health and well-being among Black women. Mental health is an integral part of Black feminism. You know, the symposium has helped in destigmatizing conversations around mental health in the Black community, especially Black women, acknowledging trauma, stress, and mental health challenges related to systemic racism, sexism, and other forms of oppression has become a huge aspect of the event. And we've really seen the impact that it has made and the connections that folks are making to better themselves and to really get the self-care out of the event.
What are the challenges to making this symposium happen? But also, what are the best parts about it?
You know, there's definitely challenges, especially with current administration, right? Where like these conversations are challenging to have in the face of folks that do not want us to have these conversations, right? Like the idea of having a Black feminist symposium is threatening to current administration. So that in and of itself is one of the main reasons, you know, that we're pushing on. We're making sure that this event stays relevant and stays of the utmost importance to the community. I think Attendance is hard, right? Like people are facing so much burnout, whether that's because of current administration or other things happening in the world right now. So getting people in the door is definitely hard. And then I would say we do get people in the door, but we would love to see so many more people in the door. We talked about it, as we evaluated this past Black Feminist Symposium of like, well, did we see our allies at the event? And the answer was no. We needed white women to show up at the event, right? Because it's just as important for them to learn about Black feminism as it is for Black women to learn about Black feminism. So it was, we're feeling those gaps. And we also thought about Black men. Like, where were our Black men during these conversations? How can we continue to bridge those gaps and bring more people into our door, bring more diverse audience into our door, and have more fruitful conversations? So those are the main things that I can think of like, it's a work in progress. But I think really like each year we really just see the impact of community, like just seeing folks build those connections with one another and find each other in the event.
I'm actually glad you mentioned the current administration, because I'd just like to have you expound on the significance of the Black Feminist Symposium, especially amid this anti-DEI sentiment where it's really being shaped that, like, any space where Black or other people of color are or have created for ourselves, we don't deserve it.
Yeah, I think, oh my gosh. I mean, each year we have hosted the Black Feminist Symposium, it has felt more and more crucial to gather in such a space. I can think of a few reasons why it's so crucial that we have this space. Firstly, I want to say just celebrating Black feminist thought, right? Black feminist thinkers, activists, and scholars have long contributed to both academic and social movements. And this symposium allows for the celebration of that legacy, and it amplifies the voices that have been historically marginalized, that we continue to see this marginalization happening in current events. As Black feminist thought continues to influence and shape contemporary movements, events like this help to preserve and propagate those important ideas. Secondly, creating community and solidarity, right? These events bring Black women allies together to share experiences and build that solidarity. We know how isolating racism, sexism, and other forms of discrimination are. So it's so important that we create spaces for community building, so we can all heal together, so we can empower one another, and so we can collectively move together to make change. And then I feel like the educational opportunities that come with events like this. These events really serve as educational tools. They provide opportunities for participants to learn about Black feminist thought, activism, and history, while also discussing contemporary challenges like we're seeing today. And this ensures that the next generation of activists, scholars, and community leaders is equipped with the knowledge and tools to continue this fight that we're in right now.
Mia Valenzuela is the Assistant Director of the Women's Resource Center at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, about the recent Black Feminist Symposium.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Eddie Morales. The question I'm exploring for this Bubbler Talk comes from listeners Amy Gajewski and her husband, Victor Munoz. I met with them at Bradford Beach. They are certified scuba divers with an interest in shipwrecks. Munoz has decades of diving experience. He explains his passion for the hobby.
I'm from Puerto Rico, so I love being underwater, grew up in the water floating around, and since I was like 15, I got scuba dive certified. Been doing it for 30 plus years.
Gajewski recently became certified to scuba dive. On their dives, she and Munoz have seen shipwrecks like the Gillen tugboat and the Prince Willem V, both about 3 miles offshore. That's why Gajewski sent Bubbler Talk this question.
Why are there so many shipwrecks in Lake Michigan, especially off of the coast of the Milwaukee area?
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist at the Wisconsin Historical Society. She tells us why.
Milwaukee, it falls on a large water highway. So before there were roads and rail into this part of the country, the easiest way to get here and to get product here out to the rest of the world was by water.
There are over 150 shipwrecks in Lower Lake Michigan. Many of them date back to the mid-1800s. Thompson says there are records of 780 shipwrecks in Wisconsin's portion of the Great Lakes. Gajewski and Munoz wanted to know how the ships met their fate. Thompson tells us more.
You know, early steamers, so they're on a wooden ship burning wood, and they tended to catch fire. Collisions and fog, before there were lighthouses and other aids to navigation that we have today. In fact, you may see a lighthouse somewhere because of the prevalence of collisions or groundings in a particular area.
Thompson shares another reason for shipwrecks, especially the ones in the Raleigh Point area of Lake Michigan by two rivers.
A lot of ships clip the coast, come really close to the point. And unfortunately there are quicksands that are on the point. And if your ship grounded and it would look like it was very softly held in this quicksand, it was like jelly and it would hold your ship there.
The eagerness to ship a product to market, coupled with freezing temperatures, often contributed to a ship's demise.
Starting your season too early or ending it too late and getting caught in ice fields. There was a mini ice age that happened on Lake Michigan, and a number of ships were crushed in the ice.
Question asker Gajewski was surprised about the reasons for these centuries-old shipwrecks.
I had no clue about the quicksands that could just grab the ships, and the ice makes a lot of sense. I recall seeing stories about ships that have gotten stuck in ice in the lakes, and it's just very interesting to learn that that is a main cause or could have been a cause as to why ships were sinking in Lake Michigan.
Thompson says shipwrecks can help us learn historical information related to imported goods and ship construction.
There are very, very few blueprints that exist today. So what we understand about ship construction is learned from the archaeological record or what we see on the bottom.
Question asker and scuba enthusiast Munoz describes what's special about Wisconsin's waters and what he sees at the bottom of a dive.
They're being preserved forever underneath the water. Obviously, you got a lot of shells and marine life that's down there that's attaching to them, but you also see how they are there and they're not going anywhere.
Thompson says the preserved wrecks are like time capsules.
They represent a point in time where there were people living aboard and sometimes died. And they tell us the stories of what shipboard life was like at a particular period.
For Gajewski and Munoz, exploring shipwrecks means bracing Lake Michigan's chilly waters. They say the dives aren't easy, but they're ready for the next one.
What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question. And join us April 10th at Gathering Place Brewing Company in River West for Bubbler Talk Trivia. Register to attend at wuwm.com.
The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound.
Did you know that you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen to us on demand. We'll take one more break, and then when we come back, we'll share some spring and summer weather safety tips. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.
The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait when the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Is that you, spring? As the weather warms, flowers bloom, and the birds return, winter may finally be in the rearview mirror for us. But while dangerously cold temperatures and icy roads may be behind us, warm weather can bring its own set of emergencies, including tornadoes and flooding. Lake Effect Sam Woods is joined by Wisconsin Emergency Management's Public Information Officer Katie Rusnellos about preparing for emergencies this spring and summer season.
So we're heading into the spring and summer months. Winter is over. The snow is melting. But Katie, does that mean that we're out of the woods for emergency weather prep?
No, it doesn't. So there's a whole host of other weather things that can happen during the warmer months when you get into spring and summer. You get thunderstorms that can produce high winds. It can produce heavy rains that can cause flooding. There's lightning. And then there's also tornadoes. And the thing is, tornadoes can happen any time of year. And we saw that in 2024 in February, where that was the first February tornado in the state. But there has been a tornado recorded in Wisconsin in every single month of the year. So some of these things aren't just based on spring or summer. Sometimes they can happen in fall and winter as well.
So when thinking about extreme spring and summer weather here in Wisconsin, what are some things that you'd like us to keep in mind?
Some things to keep in mind with severe weather season is when there is flooding, whether that's river flooding or flash flooding, please do not drive your vehicle into flooded water. You don't know how deep it is. You don't know what's in it. The same goes for walking in the water. We've all seen those videos of people sloshing in the water, walking up and down the streets, or kids playing in it. The problem with that is you don't know what's in the water. There could be liquids that are contaminating the water. There could be dangerous items that you don't see because they're covered in water that you walk on. And with floodwaters, it only takes 6 inches to knock someone over. And that could potentially be a deadly situation that you would find yourself in. Other things to pay attention to would be tornadoes. If a tornado occurs, you'll hear an outdoor siren sometimes if your community has them. That's not 100% foolproof, because think about in those summer months when you have all your windows closed and the air conditioner is running, you're not going to hear that outdoor siren. So it's important to have multiple ways to receive emergency alerts. That could include having those emergency wireless emergency alerts on your phone turned on for emergency weather information. What happens with those is the National Weather Service will send then a little alert to your area where you are located at. And it will tell you, hey, there's a tornado warning. There's, you know, take shelter now. Other things would be having an NOAA weather radio. And those are good things to have, because not only can you plug them in to an electrical outlet, they also can have batteries in there. So if there's a power outage, you can still get those alerts, even though the power's not on, because it is a battery operated radio. And other ways to get those alerts are getting a weather app on your phone that can give those weather alerts to you, getting a phone call from family and friends saying, hey, I just saw that there's a tornado near your area, or even getting that information from your local TV or radio station.
Living in the Midwest has taught me one thing, is that the weather is constantly changing. And while we may be having tornadoes today, that it may very well be 95 degrees tomorrow. So thinking of summer heat emergencies, how do I know when I'm just feeling warm versus I am feeling so warm that I should seek medical attention?
So when you're feeling warm, that's one thing, as you were saying, but some things to look out for would be heat stroke, heat exhaustion, those issues. You might be having some heavy sweating and you get cold, pale, clammy skin, fast, weak pulse. That's for heat exhaustion. For heat stroke, your body temperature is actually going to be rising up. So think like a fever. So if your temperature is 103 degrees or higher, that's very dangerous temperature to have. And if you have heat stroke, call 911 right away. It's very important to do that. And then if you are with someone who you think has heat stroke, you want to move that person to a cooler place and help lower the person's temperature with cool cloths or cool bath. Just don't give them anything to drink.
What are some common misconceptions that you hear regarding spring and summer emergency preparedness?
One of the things that I do hear occasionally from people who might be moving up to Wisconsin from a warmer climate is, I'm safe because I'm used to the heat. That's not true. No matter how familiar you are with the hot weather, the risk of heat illness still is high. So you still got to look out for those heat exhaustion, heat stroke type symptoms. And the key thing is when those hotter days come around is to make sure that you drink plenty of water. And with that, there's the caveat that while drinking water and staying hydrated is crucial, just drinking it alone is not always going to be helpful. You want to have something that has those electrolytes in there that helps maintain your body functions and prevent those heat-related illnesses.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Katie Rusnellos is Wisconsin Emergency Management's Public Information Officer. She spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Catherine Kokel, Jimmy Gutierrez, Taryn Powell, and Eric Vaughn Fellow, Maria Peralta Arellano from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn about how potential federal cuts could impact HIV prevention and treatment. Plus, we'll explore the Milwaukee Public Library zine collection. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.